Let's talk about divisive, partisan, sometimes vicious politics. You know, liberal and conservative, extremist and moderate. Everyone has an opinion, and everyone is convinced that that opinion is completely right. So there is the patriotic purist group, and then there is the pay taxes and just let it go and move on group. And there are the strict constructionists and the progressive interpreters. There are those extremists who would rather fight to the death than give an inch to the opposition. And there are those who just withdraw, who just don't want to be part of any of this hassle and just stay home. And you would think that somehow there would be some common ground, some sense of what is most important, and that all the politics could become subservient to the highest priority. So in the midst of the mess, what would Jesus say? What would Jesus do? The answer is in Matthew 22, verses 37 to 40. It's part of a conversation, a set of conversations that took place during the last week before Jesus' crucifixion, between Palm Sunday, when he came into the city of Jerusalem to applause and accolades, and Friday, when he was crucified outside the city gate. During those in-between days, Jesus had conversations with all of the different political parties, at least most of them. There were the Sadducees. They were the strict constructionists. Call them the conservatives. They insisted in always going back to the founding documents of Judaism, called the Pentateuch, or the first five books of the Bible, and considered anything else, like the rest of the Old Testament, as less than fully authoritative, that these were some sort of newfangled additions to the law. The Sadducees were a political and religious party, and for the most part, they were rich, at least richer than everybody else, and they were powerful, comprising most of the priests that were in the temple. Also that week, Jesus talked with the Pharisees. They were the liberals. They were looking always for new ways to interpret, to add to the Pentateuch, to come up with new ways of relating what we're supposed to be doing to modern and everyday life. And as a result, they came up with hundreds of new rules and regulations. So many new rules and regulations that most people couldn't even keep track of them, much less follow what they were. And then there were the Herodians. That was the pro-tax party. They figured that if you pay your taxes, it may not be a pleasant thing to do, but you support the empire, that's the way to have peace. And besides, the Roman Empire, it does a lot of good for its citizens. And there were the zealots. They were the extremists. They were the patriots who often carried weapons, were always ready for a fight. They were willing to die for their country. And they caucused with one another and reinforced one another that there should be no compromise. And the Essenes, actually, they're not there. They didn't talk to Jesus. They weren't in Jerusalem, and they're not mentioned in the record of that last week before Jesus' crucifixion, because the Essenes, well, they pretty much withdrew. Most of them lived out in the desert, in places like Qumran, and they figured they'd just leave all of the politics to everybody else, leave everything to God. So group by group, question by question, day by day, Jesus talked with these conflicting parties, and he was brilliant. He was articulate. He was amazing. But he didn't convince them. Actually, he did something that some would consider to be totally counterproductive. Instead of teaching them and convincing them, he actually brought them together. These people who were so divisive and so much hated each other came together at least temporarily and became united around a common cause to crucify the Son of God. So what did Jesus tell them about how to act in these troubled times? Well, Jesus had just astonished some in his audience when one from the Pharisees, a lawyer, came up with one of those gotcha questions. You know, the kind of question that a television reporter loves to ask and catch the interviewee by surprise, the kind of thing that's posted on a partisan blog, and it's really not intended to get an answer to the question. It's really designed to trick and to embarrass the opposition. So here's the way it went, as recorded in Luke or Matthew chapter 22. Hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, the Pharisees got together. One of them, a lawyer, an expert in the law, tested Jesus with this question. "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" Jesus replied, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment, and the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments." So Jesus invited them to cut through their entrenched positions and go to the first and the highest principle. He wasn't just telling them to think about it. He was telling them to actually do something, to act, to take all of their arguments, all of their laws, all of their politics, all of their teachings, and go back to what is first and most important. Get this right, and you can get everything else right. He says, all the law and the prophets, that is, everything that's been written in the Old Testament, they all hang on these two commandments. Jesus' words were largely ignored by those who heard him. But we are Christians. And as Christians, who we are is followers of Jesus. But as followers of Jesus, it's not just a matter of who we are, but also a matter of what we do as followers of Jesus. And here Jesus gives us a big truth that is connected together by two commandments, to love God and to love neighbor. Jesus was not giving them new words that they hadn't heard before. Actually, these words appear in the Old Testament. They're part of what is called the Shema of Israel and appear in Deuteronomy chapter 6 in the early part of the Old Testament. These are words that begin every Jewish worship service. They are the basic creed of Judaism. These are the words to be first memorized by a Jewish child. It's Moses who explained the context in Deuteronomy 6 when he said, "These are the commands, decrees, and laws the Lord your God directed me, Moses, to teach you to observe in the land that you are crossing the Jordan to possess, so that you, your children, and their children after them may fear the Lord your God as long as you live by keeping all his decrees and commands that I give you, so that you may enjoy long life. Hear, O Israel, and be careful to obey so that it may go well with you, and that you may increase greatly in a land flowing with milk and honey, just as the Lord, the God of your fathers, promised you. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the doorframe of your houses and on your gates." In other words, if you get this right, everything's going to be okay. But if you don't get this right, nothing is going to be okay. So it is, in Jesus' words, to love God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your mind. It's not a progression. It's not departmentalized. It's not as if you start with one and then move on to the other. It's complete. It's full. It's comprehensive. If I say to Charlene, "I love you with all my heart," I'm not saying next year I'll move on to my soul. And then in a few years, I may think that I love you with my mind as well. When I say I love you with all my heart, it's everything. And so we are to love God 100%. So it's about what we think, but it's not just about what we think. It's about what we do. This is about action, that we show God our love for him, short term and long term. On the best of days, when we kind of feel it, and on the worst of days, when otherwise we might be antagonistic toward God, we still act out in ways that love him. In the best of times, in the worst of times, when we are celebrating a birth or when we are grieving a death, when we are disappointed, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. Moses taught those ancient Jews to bind these words on their hands and on their foreheads. So maybe you have seen Jews today here in the Twin Cities or with a larger Jewish population in New York City, or maybe if you have visited Israel, certainly on the streets of Jerusalem, you see Jews with little black boxes. They are called tefillin or phylacteries, and they are strapped to the forehead. And they contain, among other writings, these words about God being one and about loving him 100%. Or perhaps you've been to a Jewish home, and as you walked into the front door, you saw there a small container that was up on the doorpost, and that's called a mezuzah, which is the Hebrew word for doorpost, and it contains in it a very small scroll that includes these words: "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength." Now, we may find these ancient customs to be kind of strange, but actually, I'm a great admirer of anyone who takes the Bible that seriously and has that level of conviction to act it out in that way. Most important here, we're talking about not just a box on a forehead or an arm or a hand. It is constantly thinking and talking about loving God. Moses gave great advice. Tell your children about that, so that when they are old and they look back to when they were growing up, and somebody says, "What was your childhood like?" May your children say, "My parents talked a lot about how you love God completely." Talk about God when you're out on a walk. Talk about God when you first get up in the morning. Talk about him, think about him when you go to bed at night, all throughout life. You know, we've all been around people who are just so much in love that all they can do is talk about her, talk about him, or a job or a car or a boat or a sport. And they're kind of, you know, over the top in how much they talk about "I love," and that's the way we're to be about God. They can't shut up about what or who they love. And someone who loves God with all of heart and soul and mind just can't shut up about God. But let me be candid, and by no means to lay any guilt trip on me or you or anybody else. We are often so full of other subjects. You know, we're quick to talk about weather and about politics and about sports and job and relationships. And of course, those things are a very important part of our lives. But we don't give equal time to God. You sometimes wouldn't hear much said about this kind of love toward God and might mistakenly get the impression that God is 5th or 10th or 32nd on the list. So let's put together an action list of how we can do this, starting out with telling God, "I love you." I write myself periodic reminders. I've done that again just recently, but I've been doing it for a very long time, that at least once a day, I say to God, "I love you," out loud. Try it. At least once a day, every day, be sure that you tell God that you love him. But also, tell others that you love God. It can be natural and comfortable in a conversation. You know, you say to somebody, "I've been thinking about life and what's really important to me. And what's really important to me is God, and I just love him. You know, I just want to tell you that I love God." And in the action list, speak God's name with love. There was a group of children that were gathered together, and an interviewer asked them all what love means. Four-year-old Billy said, "When someone loves you, the way they say your name is different. You just know that your name is safe in their mouth." May God's name always be safe in your mouth. And then think about specific ways to show God that you love him. If you love a child, you give a toy as a gift. If you love him or her, you send flowers or you write a note. Well, what are some specific actions and ways to show God, I love you? And avoid behavior that hurts the God that we love. You know that if in a marriage one person is unfaithful to the other, that causes such a deep hurt that there are not adequate words to describe it. And so if we are unfaithful to God, we deeply hurt him. That means that we think through and we make choices of behavior that do not offend God, that do not hurt him. It is that we make everything in life flow out of this all-consuming love for God. So you play a game, you go to work, you drive a car, you save money, you spend money, you raise children, you get married, all of those things that make everything in life connected to an expression of this all-out love for the Lord your God. Talking to the Sadducees and Pharisees and Zealots and Herodians and others, Jesus didn't stop with what he described as the first and greatest commandment. He moved on to talk about a second one. He said, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself." So Jesus here became powerfully practical when he linked our love for God with our love for others. I know there are some people that think, well, that's kind of a burden. It's kind of a drag on life to have to love neighbors. But those who truly love God see it not as a burden, but see it as an opportunity. After all, God, we don't see him, and he can sometimes seem distant. And how do you send flowers to the God that created all flowers? What do you do? And Jesus said, this you can do. You can show God your love by the way you treat your neighbor. Those who heard Jesus say this had heard these words before, for they also are in the Old Testament. In Leviticus 19:18, love your neighbor as yourself, I am the Lord. But there were many, probably most Jews in Jesus' day, who had a very narrow definition of who is a neighbor, who would say that my neighbor is someone like me, someone who is religiously and ethnically just like me. Some of them went so narrow as to say also part of my political party or my neighborhood or my particular clan. But Jesus gave a whole new perspective on who is a neighbor when he told what has become the famous story of the Good Samaritan. It's recorded in the New Testament in Luke chapter 10, how on one occasion, actually it was another lawyer, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he asked, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" "What is written in the law?" he replied. "How do you read it?" He answered, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself." "Good job. You've answered correctly," Jesus replied. "Do this and you will live." But he wanted to justify himself. Isn't that an interesting line? He wanted to find a loophole. He wanted to play a word game. Often when we really don't want to do what we are supposed to do, we find some way around it that makes us look okay without doing what is the right thing to do. So he wanted to justify himself, and he asked Jesus, "Yeah, and who is my neighbor?" In reply, Jesus said, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he fell into the hands of robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. a priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, took him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day, he took out 2 silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper. "Look after him," he said, "and when I return, I will reimburse you if there's any extra expense that you may have." Which of these 3 do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? The expert in the law replied, "The one who had mercy on him." Jesus told him, "Well, then you go and do likewise." This story, it just reveals the heart of Jesus. Just see and sense who Jesus is. When he tells us about who he perceives to be our neighbor and how we relate to a neighbor. So interesting. Jesus doesn't condemn the man who was robbed. Other people have. There are those who have well noted that the road between Jerusalem and Jericho was sort of lined with bandits. It was a very, very dangerous route. And so typically people would travel in caravans. They would have guards. You had to be careful because otherwise you're going to be in trouble. You could be robbed, beaten, killed. And you sort of get the impression that this guy didn't pay any attention to that. You might think him pretty self-sufficient and arrogant. And therefore, you might come to the conclusion that, well, he just had it coming. This was his own fault. And maybe it was. Maybe he just should have known better than to do what he did, and he got himself into a mess. But Jesus never says any of that. Jesus, he doesn't condemn the guy for the situation he's in. Nor does he criticize the priest and the Levite. A Levite being someone else who worked in the temple and the religious rituals of the day. There are those who have pointed out that organized religion and religious people, and you know, if anybody should have helped this guy, these are the ones that should have done it. But Jesus, he doesn't criticize them. Perhaps they were busy, perhaps they had some religious scruples, perhaps. But Jesus says none of that. He just says they didn't help. And then he names a Samaritan. Samaritans were discriminated against. They were marginalized in that society. In fact, you could really say that they were pretty much hated, that the establishment of Judaism in those days didn't have much of anything to do with Samaritans unless they absolutely had to. And the Samaritan, he had his own destination. He may have been part of a caravan himself. He didn't have to help. He wasn't obligated in any way. And yet he became vulnerable. He got this other guy's dirt, blood on his clothes. He gave his money for a total stranger. He took the wounded man to an inn and made provision, even left an open tab. So he could have been ripped off. Maybe he was ripped off. The Samaritan was just someone who loved a neighbor that he didn't even know. And so Jesus calls us to action, to love our neighbors as we love ourselves. You know, it's really quite simple, this as yourselves. If your baby were starving because of the famine and the politics of Somalia, what would you want a Christian to do for you? If you were really sick and didn't have any insurance and your next door neighbor was a follower of Jesus, what would you like your next door neighbor to do for you? If you really needed a job and you had a friend who was a Christian, or just somebody down the road that you don't even know that's a Christian, what would you like that person to do for you? If you're driving along and you skidded off the road and you're hurt and you can't help yourself and a Christian were driving along on the highway, what would you like that Christian to do for you? Jesus is saying that we are to love our neighbors as ourselves. But when I hear the heart and the head of Jesus
and I think about all these needs, I realize they are so far beyond my own personal capacity. I can't feed. They say 500,000 are going to starve to death in Somalia and the Horn of Africa. I can't get everybody a job that's unemployed. I can't help everybody that's beat up. But I can do something. I can have a heart. I can care. I can choose to sacrifice instead of being selfish. I can choose to be generous instead of being greedy. I can pray for those whom I maybe don't even know. Jesus tied all this together in a sermon that is recorded at the end of the New Testament Gospel of Matthew, Matthew 25. It actually has some very confrontational parts of it. I'll just read you a little bit of Jesus' sermon where he's talking about the end of history, and Jesus, the king, is sitting on the throne, not only as a monarch, but also as a judge, and he's judging us. He's judging all of humankind. And so in his sermon, Jesus said that then the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you're the one who clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me." And then the righteous will answer, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?" And King Jesus will reply, "I tell you the truth, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me." So hear and do the words of Jesus. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. For this is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is just like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. God, we do love you. Listen to us. We love you. And we want to live the love that we have in our hearts. Give us opportunity and let us seek the opportunity to declare our love to you and to show that love in the way we treat our neighbors. In Jesus' name, amen.